of quarters, picked up and moved. Towns intoxicated with wealth. Other towns affecting sleep, squirreling away money, certificates, deeds in unpainted houses on unpaved streets. In one of the prosperous ones, he and Stuart watched 19 Negro ladies arrange themselves on the steps of the town hall. They wore summer dresses of material, the lightness, the delicacy of which neither of them had ever seen. Most of the dresses were white, but two were lemon yellow and one a salmon color. They wore small, pale hats of beige, dusty rose, powdery blue, hats that called attention to the wide, sparkly eyes of the wearers. Their waists were not much bigger than their necks. Laughing and teasing, they preened for a photographer, lifting his head from beneath a black cloth, only to hide under it again. Following a successful pose, the ladies broke apart in small groups, bending their tiny waists with rippling laughter, walking arm in arm. One adjusted another's brooch. One exchanged her pocketbook with another. Slender feet turned and tipped in thin leather shoes, their skin creamy and luminous in the afternoon sun, took away his breath. A few of the younger ones crossed the street and walked past the rail fence, close, so close, to where he and Stuart sat. They were on their way to a restaurant just beyond. Deke heard musical voices, low, full of delight and secret information, and in their tow a gust of verbena. The twins did not even look at each other. Without a word, they agreed to fall off the railing. While they wrestled on the ground, ruining their pants and shirts, the Negro ladies turned around to see. Deke and Stuart got the smiles they wanted before Big Daddy interrupted his conversation and stepped off the porch to pick each son up by his pants waist, haul them both onto the porch, and crack butt with his walking stick. Even now, the verbena scent was clear. Even now, the summer dresses, the creamy, sunlit skin excited him. If he and Stuart had not thrown themselves off the railing, they would have burst into tears. So amid the vivid details of that journey, the sorrow, the stubbornness, the cunning, the wealth, Deke's image of the 19 summertime ladies was unlike the photographer's. His remembrance was pastel-colored and eternal. The morning after the meeting at Calvary, pleased with his bird quota and fired, not tired, from no sleep, he decided to check out the oven before opening up the bank. So he turned left instead of right on Central and drove past the school on the west side, Ace's Grocery, Fleetwood's Furniture and Appliance, and several houses on the east. When he arrived at the site, he circled it. Except for a few soda cans and some paper that had escaped the trash barrel, the place was blank. No fists, no loungers. He should speak to Anna Flood, who owned Ace's store now, get her to clean up the pop cans and mess that came from purchases made at her store. That's what Ace, her father, used to do. Swept that place like it was his own kitchen, inside and out, and if you'd let him, he'd sweep all across the road. Pulling back onto Central, Deke noticed Meisner's beat-up Ford parked at Anna's. Beyond, to his left, he could hear schoolchildren group reciting a poem he'd learned by rote, too. except he had had to hear Dunbar's lines only once to memorize them completely and forever. When he and Stuart had enlisted, there was a lot to learn, from how to tie an army tie to how to pack a bag. And just as they had in Haven's schoolhouse, they had been first to understand everything, remember everything. But none of it was as good as what they learned at home, sitting on the floor in a firelit room, listening to war stories, to stories of great migrations, those who made it and those who did not, to the failures and triumphs of intelligent men, their fear, their bravery, their confusion, to tales of love, deep and permanent, all there in the one book they owned then. Black leather covers with gold lettering, the pages thinner than young leaves, than petals, the spine frayed into webbing at the top, the corners fingered down to skin, the strong words, strange at first, becoming familiar, gaining weight and hypnotic beauty the more they heard them, made them their own. As Deke drove north on Central, it and the side streets seemed to him as satisfactory as ever. Quiet, white and yellow houses, full of industry, and in them were elegant black women at useful tasks, orderly cupboards minus surfeit or miserliness, linen laundered and ironed to perfection, good meat seasoned and ready for roasting. It was a view he would be damned if KD or the idleness of the young would disturb. It was a far cry from the early days of Haven, and his grandfather would have scoffed at the ease of it, buying property with dollars ready to hand, instead of trading years of labor for it. He would have been embarrassed by grandsons who worked 12 hours, 5 days a week, instead of the 18 to 20-hour days Haven people once needed just to keep alive, and who could hunt quail for pleasure rather than the desperate need to meet a wife and 8 children at table without shame. And his cold, roomy eyes would have narrowed at the sight of the oven. No longer the meeting place to report on what done or what needed, on illness, births, deaths, comings and goings. The oven that had witnessed the baptized, injuring, sanctified life was now reduced to watching the lazy young. 2 of Sargent's boys, 3 of Poole's, 2 Seawrights, 2 Beauchamps, a couple of Dupre children, Soots and Pious girls, even Arnett and Pat Best's only child used to dawdle there, all of whom ought to be somewhere chopping, canning, mending, fetching. The oven whose every brick had heard live chords praising his name was now subject to radio music, record music, music already dead when it filtered through a black wire trailing from Anna's store to the oven like a snake. But his grandfather would have been pleased, too. Instead of children and adults convening at night in those early days to scratch letters and figures with pebbles on scraps of shale, learning to read from those who could. There was a schoolhouse here, too, not as big as the one they'd built in Haven, but it was open 8 months a year, and no begging the state for money to run it, not 1 cent. And just as Big Papa foretold, if they stayed together, worked, prayed, and defended together, they would never be like Downs, Lexington, Sepulpa, Gans, where colored were run out of town overnight. Nor would they be among the dead and maimed of Tulsa, Norman, Oklahoma City, not to mention victims of spontaneous whippings, murders, and depopulation by arson. Except for a crack here, a chink there, everything in Ruby was intact. There was no need to wonder if moving the oven had been a mistake, whether it needed its original soil as foundation for the respect and wholesome utility that was its due. No. No, Big Papa. No, Big Daddy. We did right. Deke reassured himself with more force than confidence, for he was increasingly uneasy about Soane. Nothing he could put his fingernail under, just a steady sense of losing ground. He shared her sadness, believed he felt the loss of sons precisely and keenly as she did, except he knew more about it than she did. He, like most of the Morgans, had seen action, which is to say, live death, watched it when it was visited on others, watched it when he visited it on others. He knew that bodies did not lie down, that most often they flew apart, and that what had been shipped to them in those boxes, what they pulled off the train platform in Middleton, was a collection of parts that weighed half of what a 19-year-old would. Easter and Scout were integrated units, and if Soane thought about it, she might consider herself lucky to know that whatever was missing, the parts were all of black men, which was a courtesy and a rule the medics tried hard to apply for fear of adding white thighs and feet to a black head. If Soane suspected what was likely, oh man. He regretted having slipped up over coffee and mentioned what Roger was unable to do. He did not want her even to imagine the single question he put to Roger. First with Scout, then with Easter. Are all the parts black? Meaning, if not, get rid of the white pieces. Roger swore to their racial consistency, and the regal coffins were a sign of Morgan gratitude and a source of balm for Soane. Still, the residue of that loss seemed to be accumulating in a way he could not control. He did not trust the medicine she took, and he certainly did not trust its source. But there was nothing in her behavior he could fault. She was as beautiful as it was possible for a good woman to be. She kept a good home and did good works everywhere. Was, in fact, more generous than he would have liked. But that was hardly a complaint. There was nothing to do about it. Soane was burdened with the loss of two sons. He was burdened with the loss of all sons. Since his twin had no children, the Morgans had arrived at the end of the line. Well, yes, there were elders' children, a flock of them roosting everywhere except at home, some of whom visited Ruby for a week only to cut it short, so eager were they to get away from the peace they found dull, the industry they found tedious, and the heat they found insulting. So it was useless even to think of them as part of the legitimate line of Morgans. He and Stuart were truer heirs, proof of which was Ruby itself. Who, other than the rightful heirs, would have repeated exactly what Zachariah and Rector had done? But since part of the charge had been to multiply, it was a heavy hurt to know that K.D. was the only means by which they could. K.D., son of a sister and the army buddy they gave her to. The knot that formed in Deke's chest whenever he thought about her was familiar. Ruby, that sweet, modest, laughing girl whom he and Stuart had protected all their lives. She had gotten sick on the trip, seemed to heal, but failed rapidly again. When it became clear she needed serious medical help, there was no way to provide it. They drove her to Denby, then further to Middleton. No colored people were allowed in the wards. No regular doctor would attend them. She had lost control, then consciousness, by the time they got to the second hospital. She died on the waiting room bench while the nurse tried to find a doctor to examine her. When the brothers learned the nurse had been trying to reach a veterinarian and they gathered their dead sister in their arms, their shoulders shook all the way home. Ruby was buried, without benefit of a mortuary, in a pretty spot on Stewart's ranch. And it was then that the bargain was struck. A prayer in the form of a deal, no less, with God, no less, which he seemed to honor until 1969, when Easter and Scout were shipped home. After that, they understood the terms and conditions of the deal much better. Perhaps they had made a mistake in 1970, discouraging KD and Fleet's daughter. She was pregnant, but after a short stay at that convent, if she had it, she sure didn't have it. The uncles had been worried about the shape Fleetwood's offspring took, and besides, there were other suitable candidates around. But KD was still messing around with one of the strays living out there, where the entrance to hell is wide, and it was time to give him the news. Every brothel don't hang a red light in the window. He was breaking in front of the bank when he noticed a solitary figure ahead. He recognized her right away, but watched her carefully because, first of all, she had no coat, and because, second, he had not seen her out of her house in 6 years. Central Avenue, 3 wide graded miles of tarmac, began at the oven and ended at Sargent's Feed and Seed. The 4 side streets east of Central were named after the Gospels. When a 5th street was needed, it was named St. Peter. Later on, as Ruby grew, streets were laid on the west side of Central, and although these newer streets were continuations of those on the east, situated right across from them, they acquired secondary names. So St. John Street on the east became Cross John on the west. St. Luke became Cross Luke. The sanity of this pleased most everybody, Deke especially, and there was always room for additional houses, financed, if need be, by the Morgan Brothers Bank, in the plots and acres behind and beyond those already built. The woman Deke was watching seemed to be leaving Cross Peter Street and heading toward Sargent's Feed and Seed, but she did not stop there. Instead, she was moving resolutely north, where Deke knew there was nothing for 17 miles. What could the sweetest girl, named for her nature, be doing coatless on a chilly October morning that far from the home she had not stepped out of since 1967? A movement in his rearview mirror took his attention, and he recognized the small red truck coming from South Country. Its driver would be Aaron Poole, late, as Deke knew he would be, since he was bringing in the final payment on his loan. After considering letting Poole wait and driving on to catch up with Sweetie, Deke cut off his motor. July, his clerk and secretary, was not due until 10. There should be no occasion when the bank of a good and Sirius Town did not open on time. Anna Flood said, "See, just look at him." She was watching Deke's sedan circle the oven and then cruise slowly past her store. "Why does he have to hover like that?" Richard Meisner looked up from the wood stove. "He's just checking on things," he said, and went back to laying the fire. "Got a right, doesn't he? It's sort of his town, wouldn't you say? His and Stewart's." "I would not. They may act like they own it, but they don't." Meisner liked a tight fire, and the one he was preparing would be just that. "Well, they founded it, didn't they? Who've you been talking to?" Anna left the window and walked to the back stairs leading to her apartment. There she slid a pan of meat leavings and cereal under the stairwell. The cat, turned vicious by motherhood, stared at her with warning eyes. 15 families founded this town. 15, not 2. One was my father, another my uncle. "You know what I mean," Meisner interrupted her. Anna peeped into the darkness, trying to see inside the box where the litter lay. "I do not." "The money," said Meisner. "The Morgans had the money. I guess I should say they financed the town, not founded it." The cat would not eat while being watched, so Anna forfeited a peep at the kittens and turned back to Richard Meisner. "You wrong there, too. Everybody pitched in. The bank idea was just a way of doing it. Families bought shares in it, you know, instead of just making deposits they could run through any old time. This way, their money was safe." Meisner nodded and wiped his hands. He didn't want another argument. Anna refused to understand the difference between investing and cooperating, just as she refused to believe the wood stove gave more warmth than her little electric heater. "The Morgans had the resources, that's all," she said, "from their father's bank back in Haven. My grandfather, Abel Flood, was his partner. Everybody called him Big Daddy, but his real name was, I know, Rector Morgan, also known as Big Daddy, son of Zechariah Morgan, known throughout Christendom as Big Papa." And then he quoted a refrain the citizens of Ruby love to recite. "Rector's bank failed, but he didn't." "It's true. The bank had to close down in the early 40s, but it didn't close out. I mean, they had enough so we could start over. I know what you're thinking, but you can't honestly say it didn't work. People prosper here. Everybody. Everybody's prospering on credit, Anna. That's not the same thing. So what if the credit's gone? It can't be gone. We own the bank. The bank doesn't own us." "Oh, Anna, you don't get it, do you? You don't understand." She enjoyed his face, even when he was putting down people she liked. Stewart, for example, he seemed to despise. But it was Stewart who had taught her the scorpion lesson. When Anna was 4, she was sitting on the new porch of her father's store back in 1954, when everybody was building something while a group of men, including Stewart, were helping Ace Flood finish the shelving. They were inside, resting after a quick lunch, while Anna derailed ants on the steps, introducing obstacles into their roots, watching them climb over the leaf's edge and go on as though a brand new green mountain were an inevitable part of their journey. Suddenly, a scorpion shot out near her bare foot, and she ran wide-eyed into the store. The talk stopped while the men weighed this infantile interruption, and it was Steward who picked her up in his arms and asked, "What's bothering you, good-looking?" and relieved her fears. Anna clung to him while he explained that the scorpion's tail was up because it was just as scared of her as she was of it. In Detroit, watching baby-faced police handling guns, she remembered the scorpion's rigid tail. Once, she had asked Stuart what it felt to be a twin. "Can't say," he answered, "since I was never not one, but I guess it feels more complete." "Like you can never be lonely?" Anna asked. "Well, yes, like that, but more like superior." When Ace died, she came back to Ruby and was about to sell out the store, the apartment, the car, everything, and return to Detroit when he came riding into town, alone in a beat-up Ford, Calvary's new minister. Anna folded her arms on the wooden counter. "I own this store. My daddy died, it's mine. No rent, no mortgage, just taxes, town fees. I buy things, I sell things. The markup is mine." "You're lucky. What about the farms? Suppose a crop fails, say 2 years in a row. Does old Mrs. Sands or Nathan Dupre get to take out their share, borrow on it, sell it to the bank? What? I don't know what they do, but I do know it's no gain to the bank for them to lose it. So they give them money to buy more seed, guano, whatever." "You mean lend them the money? You're making my head ache. Where you come from, all that might be true. Ruby's different. Hope so. Is so. Any problem brewing sure ain't money." "Well, what is it then?" "Hard to figure. But I don't like the way Deke's face looks when he's checking the oven. He does it every day God sends now. More like hunting than checking. They're just kids." That fist painting scared a lot of people. "Why? It was a picture. You'd think somebody had burned a cross." Annoyed, she started wiping things, jars, case fronts, the soda pop cooler. "He should talk to the parents, not go hunting for the kids like he's the sheriff. Kids need more than what's here." Meisner couldn't agree more. Since the murder of Martin Luther King, new commitments had been sworn, laws introduced, but most of it was decorative. Statues, street names, speeches. It was as though something valuable had been pawned and the claim ticket lost. That's what Destry, Roy, Little Mirth, and the rest were looking for. Maybe the fist painter was looking for it too. In any case, if they couldn't find the ticket, they might break into the pawn shop. Question was, who pawned it in the first place, and why? "You told me that's why you left. Nothing to do, but you never said why you came back." Anna wasn't about to explain all of that, so she elaborated on what he already knew. "Yeah, well, thought I could do something up north, something real that wouldn't break my heart. But it was all, I don't know, talk, running around. I got confused. Still, I don't regret going one bit, even though it didn't work out." "Well, I'm glad it didn't, whatever the reason." He stroked her hand. Anna returned his touch. "I'm worried," she said, "about Billy Delia. We have to come up with something, Richard. Something more than choir competitions and Bible class and ribbons for fat vegetables and baby showers. What about her?" "Oh, I don't know. She came in here a while back, and I knew right away she had something on her mind. But the truck was late with my goods, so I was short with her." "Which is to say what?" "She's gone off. At least I think so. Nobody's seen her. What does her mother say? Anna shrugged. Pat's hard to talk to. Kate asked her about Billy Delia. Hadn't seen her at choir practice. Know what she did? Answered Kate's question with another. Anna mimicked Pat Best's soft, cold voice. Why do you need to know that? She and Kate are close, too. You think she's courting harm? She couldn't just disappear without anybody knowing where to? I don't know what I think. Talk to Roger. He should know. He's her grandfather. You ask him, not me. Say, what is all this feeling about Roger? I've been here 3 years almost, and I can't make out why folks freeze around him. Is it his mortuary business? Probably. That and, well, he prepared, if you get my meaning, his own wife. Oh, that's something to think about, ain't it? Still, they were quiet for a moment, thinking about it. Then Anna walked around the counter and stood at the window. You know, you're right smart about weather. This is the third time I disbelieved you and was proved wrong. Meisner joined her, just touching the pain. They could tell the temperature had dropped suddenly into the teens. Go ahead, light it, she said, laughing and happy to be wrong if it made this man she adored right. There were church women who disapproved of his obvious interest in her, and nobody else, and Pat Best was skilled at hiding her own interest in him. But Anna thought there was more to it than perhaps their own plans for this handsome, intelligent man and their various daughters and nieces. She was certain the disapproval was mostly because of her unstraightened hair. My God, the conversations she had been forced to have when she came back from Detroit. Strange, silly, invasive probings. She felt as though they were discussing her pubic hair, her underarm hair, that if she had walked completely naked down the street, they would have commented only on the hair on her head. The subject summoned more passion, invited more opinions, solicited more anger than the prostitute menace brought home from Virginia. She probably would have straightened it again eventually. It wasn't a permanent change or a statement, except it clarified so much for her in the days when she was confused about so much else. Instantly, she could identify friends and those who were not, recognize the well-brought-up, the ill-raised, the threatened, the insecure. Dovey Morgan liked it. Pat Best hated it. Deke and Stewart shook their heads. Kate Golightly loved it and helped her keep it shaped. Reverend Pulliam preached a whole sermon about it. K.D. laughed at it. Most of the young people admired it, except Arnett. Like a Geiger counter, her hair registered, she believed, tranquility or the intensity of a rumbling, deep-down disorder. The fire, smelling wonderfully, attracted the mother cat. She curled up behind the stove, though her eyes remained alert to predators, human or otherwise. Let me make some coffee, Anna said, eyeing the clouds above Holy Redeemer. This might get serious. Ace Flood's faith had been the mountain-moving kind, so he built his store to last. Sandstone, sturdier than some churches, 4 rooms for his family above. Below, a spacious storeroom, a tiny bedroom, and a 15-foot-high selling area, crammed with shelves, bins, cases, and drawers. The windows were regular house type. He didn't want or need display. No big, wasteful, looking in plate glass for him. Let folks come inside to see what he had. He didn't have many things, but he had a lot of what he stocked. Before he died, he saw his store change from a necessary service in Ruby to a business patronized by the loyal for certain items, though they balked at his prices and more drove their trucks to Denby for cheaper and better supplies. Anna changed all that. What Ace's Grocery now lacked in size of inventory, it gained in variety and style. She offered free coffee on cold days, iced tea when it was hot. She put out two chairs and a small table for the elderly and those who drove in from farms and wanted to rest a while. And since adults nowadays never frequented the oven next to her store, except for special events, she catered to the appetites of the young who liked to gather there. She sold her own pies, made her own candy, along with the lots she picked up in Denby. She kept three kinds of soda pop instead of one. Sometimes she sold the black as eight rock peppers the convent grew. She kept hogshead cheese in the cooler, as her father had, along with local butter and salted pork. But canned goods, dried beans, coffee, sugar, syrup, baking soda, flour, salt, ketchup, paper products, all the items nobody could or wanted to make at home, took up the space Ace Flood once used for cloth, work shoes, light tools, kerosene. Now, Sergeant's Feed and Seed sold the shoes, the tools, the kerosene, and Harper's Drugstore sold the needles, thread, counter medicine, prescriptions, sanitary napkins, stationery, and tobacco. Except for Blue Boy, Stewart had relied on Ace for that and wasn't about to change his habits. In Anna's hands, Ace's Grocery blossomed through variety, comfort, and flexibility. Because she let Menace cut hair in the back on Saturdays, incidental purchases rose. Because she had a nice toilet downstairs, casual users felt obliged to become customers before they left. Farming women came in for peppermint after church, the men for sacks of raisins. Invariably, they picked up a little something more from the shelves. The contentment she drew from Richard's fire made her smile. But she couldn't be a minister's wife. Never. Could she? Well, he had not asked her to be one, so enjoy the stove heat, the nape of his neck, and the invisible presence of kittens. After a while, a station wagon drove up and parked so close to the store, both Meisner and Anna could see the fever in the baby's blue eyes. The mother held the child over her shoulder and stroked its yellow hair. The driver, a city-dressed man in his 40s, got out and pushed open Anna's door. "How you all doing?" he smiled. "Fine. And you?" "Look like I'm lost. Been trying to find 18 West for more than an hour." He looked at Meisner and grinned an apology for having violated the male rule of never asking for directions. "Wife made me stop, said she's headed." "It's a ways back the way you come from," said Meisner, looking at the Arkansas plates. "But I can tell you how to find it." "Appreciate it. Appreciate it," said the man. "Don't expect there's a doctor around here, is there?" "Not around these parts. You have to get to Denby for that." "What's wrong with the baby?" Anna asked. "Sort of pukey, hot too. We're fairly well supplied, but who'd pack aspirin or cough medicine in a little old trip like this? Can't think of every damn thing, can you? Jesus. Your baby coughing? I don't believe you need cough medicine. Anna squinted through the window. Ask your wife to come in out the cold. Drugstore'll have aspirin, said Meisner. I don't see no drugstore. Whereabouts is it? You passed it, but it don't look like a drugstore. It looks like a regular house. How am I going to find it then? Houses around here don't seem to have numbers. Tell me what all you want, and I'll get it for you. Then tell your wife to bring that baby inside. Meisner reached for his coat. Just some aspirin and some cough medicine. Appreciate it. I'll get my wife. The blast from the open door rattled the coffee cups. The man got back in the station wagon. Meisner took off in his ratty Ford. Anna thought about making some cinnamon toast. The pumpkin bread would be stale now. Be nice if she had an overripe banana. The baby looked constipated. Mush it up with a little apple butter. The man came back shaking his head. I'll just keep the motor running. She says she'll stay put. Anna nodded. You got far to go? Lubbock. Say, is that coffee hot? Uh-huh. How do you like it? Black and sweet. He'd taken two sips when the station wagon horn sounded. Shit. Excuse me, he said. When he came back, he bought licorice, peanut butter, crackers, and three royal crowns, and carried them out to his wife. Then he returned to finish his coffee, sipping it in silence while Anna poked the fire. You better gas up when you get on 18. Blizzard's coming. He laughed. Blizzard? In Lubbock, Texas? You ain't in Texas yet, said Anna. She looked toward the window and saw two figures approach. Then Meisner shouldered open the door with Stewart close on his heels. Here you go, said Meisner, handing over the bottles. The man took them and rushed out to the station wagon. Meisner followed to give him directions. Who all is that? Asked Stewart. Just some lost folks. Anna handed him a 32-ounce tin of Blue Boy. Lost folks or lost whites? Oh, Stewart, please. Big difference, Anna girl. Big. Right, Reverend? Meisner was just stepping back in. They get lost, like everybody else, said Anna. Born lost. Take over the world and still lost. Right, Reverend? You just contradicted yourself, Anna laughed. God has warned people, Stewart. You know that. Meisner rubbed his hands, then blew on them. Reverend, said Stewart, I heard you say things out of ignorance, but this is the first time I heard you say something based on ignorance. Meisner smiled and was about to answer when the lost man entered again to pay Meisner for the medicine. Blizzard's heading in. Stewart looked at the man's light clothing and thin shoes. You might want to ride it out somewhere. Gas station on 18. Wouldn't go no further than that if I was you. I'll beat it. The man closed his wallet. I'll gas up on 18, but we're crossing that state line today. Thank you. You all been a big help. Appreciate it. They never listen, said Stewart, as the station wagon drove away. He himself, having been around in 1958, when whole herds froze, had been pumping water, nailing down, forking alfalfa, and storing up since Wednesday. He was in town for tobacco and syrup, and to pick up Dovey. Say, Stewart, Meisner said, you seen Roger's granddaughter, Billy Delia? What should I see her for? Anna says nobody has. Of course, we haven't asked her mother. Stewart, picking up on the we, put a crisp $5 bill on the counter. You won't get nothing there, he said, thinking, no major loss if she did run off. Serve Pat right, he thought. She noses about in everybody's business, but clams up if you get near hers. That reminds me. Deke told me he saw Sweetie this morning, just walking on down the road. No overcoat, nothing. Sweetie? Out of her house? Anna stressed her disbelief. Down what road? Asked Meisner. Not Sweetie. Deke swears it was her. Must have been, said Meisner. I saw her too, right outside my house. I thought she was going to knock, but she turned around and headed back towards Central. Looked to me like she was going on home. Didn't. Deke said she was way past Sergeant's, marching out of town like a soldier. Didn't he stop her? Seward stared at Anna, as though he couldn't believe her words. He was opening up the bank, girl. Meisner frowned. Anna cut off anything he might have been about to say with, you all want some coffee? Maybe some pumpkin bread? Both men accepted. Somebody better speak to Jeff. It was Anna's voice, but all three glanced at a wall of shelves, beyond which was Fleetwood's furniture and appliance. Despite the predictions from Richard Meisner's gaze, Stuart Morgan's watchfulness, a tiny piece of the sky flashed a watercolor palette, orange peach, minty green, seashore blue. The rest of the sky, pewter, served to brighten this odd picture book sunbreak. It lasted a full hour and thrilled everybody who saw it. Then it faded, and a leaden sky solidified over the relentless wind. By noon, the first snow came, stinging pellets, popping, not melting, before the wind. The second snow, 2 hours later, didn't pop. It lay down quietly and covered everything there was. Sweetie had said, be back directly, Miss Mabel. Won't be gone but a minute, Miss Mabel. Meant to say it. Maybe she did say it. Anyway, it was in her head to say, but she had to hurry quick before one of them gurgled. On the porch, the walkway, Sweetie's stride was purposeful, as though there were somewhere important she had to be. Something important she had to do, and it would take just a few minutes, and she would be right back, in time to massage a little bottom to keep the sores away, or to siphon phlegm, or grind food, or clean teeth, or trim nails, or launder out urine, or cradle in her arms, or sing, but mostly in time to watch, to never take her eyes off, unless her mother-in-law was there, and to watch then as well, because Miss Mabel's eyes weren't as sharp as they once had been. Others offered help, repeatedly at first, irregularly now, but she always declined. Sweetie was the best at watching, her mother-in-law second best. Arnett used to be good, but not anymore. Jeff and her father-in-law couldn't look, let alone watch. The problem had never been watching while she was awake. It was watching while asleep. For 6 years, she slept on the pallet near the cribs, or in bed with Jeff, her breath threaded, her ear tunnel ready, every muscle braced to spring. She knew she slept because she dreamed a little, although she couldn't remember what about. But it was getting harder and harder to watch and sleep at the same time. When dawn broke, and Mabel came into the room with a cup of coffee, Sweetie stood to take it. She knew Mabel had already run her bath water and folded a towel and fresh nightgown over the chair in the bedroom, and she knew she would offer to do her hair, braid it, wash it, roll it, or just scratch her scalp. The coffee would be wonderful, dark, and loaded with sugar. But she also knew that if she drank it this one time and went to bed in the morning sun this one time, she would never wake up. And who would watch her babies then? So she took the coffee and said, or meant to, "Be back in a minute, Miss Mabel." Downstairs, she put the cup and saucer on the dining table. Then, unwashed, coatless, and with uncombed hair, she opened the front door and left, quickly. She was not hoping to walk until she dropped, or fainted, or froze, and then slipped into nothingness for a while. The small thing she wanted was not to have that dawn coffee, the already drawn bath, the folded nightgown, and then the watchful sleep in that order forever, every day, and in particular, this here particular day. The only way to change the order, she thought, was not to do something differently, but to do a different thing. Only one possibility arose, to leave her house and step into a street she had not entered in 6 years. Sweetie traveled the length of Central Avenue, past the gospel-named streets, past New Zion, Harper's Drugstore, the bank, Mount Calvary. She detoured into Cross Peter, left it, and walked past Sargent's Feed and Seed. North of Ruby, where the quality of the road changed twice, her legs were doing brilliantly. So was her skin, for she didn't feel the cold. The fresh outside air, to which she was unaccustomed, hurt her nostrils, and she set her face to bear it. She did not know she was smiling, nor did the girl staring at her from the bed of a brand new 73 pickup. The girl thought Sweetie was crying, and a black woman weeping on a country road broke her heart all over again. She peered at Sweetie from her hiding place among empty crates. The Ford truck heading south slowed as it passed Sweetie, then stopped. In the cab, the driver and his wife exchanged looks. Then the driver leaned out the window, twisting his head to holler at Sweetie's back, "You need some help?" Sweetie did not turn her head or acknowledge the offer. The couple looked at each other and sucked teeth as the husband shifted into drive. Fortunately, the road inclined at that point. Otherwise, the broken-hearted hitchhiker would have hurt herself when she jumped from the back of the truck. The couple could see in the rearview mirror a passenger they didn't know they had, running to join the pitiful, ill-raised creature who had not even said no thank you. When the girl whose heart was breaking caught up with the woman, she knew enough not to touch or speak or insert herself into the determined bubble the crying woman had become. She walked 10 or so paces behind, studying the shapely dark ankles above worn white loafers, the wrinkled shirtwaist dress, pale blue with sagging pockets, the sleeper's hair pressed flat on one side, disheveled on the other, and every now and then a sob that sounded like a giggle. They moved this way for more than a mile, the walker going somewhere, the hitcher going anywhere, the wraith and her shadow, The morning was cold, cloudy. Wind streamed the tall grasses on either side of the road. 15 years ago, when the broken-hearted hitcher was 5 years old, she had spent 4 nights and 5 days knocking on every door in her building. "Is my sister in here?" Some said no. Some said who? Some said, "What's your name, little girl?" Most didn't open the door at all. That was 1958, when a child could play all over brand new government housing in safety. The first 2 days, after making her rounds on floors ever higher, higher, and making sure she had not missed a single door, she waited. Jean, her sister, would be coming back any time now, because dinner food was on the table. Meatloaf, string beans, ketchup, white bread, and a full pitcher of Kool-Aid was in the refrigerator. She occupied herself with 2 coloring books, a deck of cards, and a wedding baby doll. She drank milk, ate potato chips, saltines with apple jelly, and, little by little, the whole meatloaf. By the time the hated string beans were all that was left of the dinner, they were too shriveled and mushy to bear. The third day, she began to understand why Jean was gone and how to get her back. She cleaned her teeth, washed her ears carefully. She also flushed the toilet right away as soon as she used it and folded her socks inside her shoes. She spent a long time wiping up the Kool-Aid and picking up the pieces of glass from the pitcher that crashed when she tried to lift it from the refrigerator. She remembered the Lorna Doones that were in the bread box, but dared not climb up on a chair to open it. Those were her prayers. If she did everything right, without being told, either Jean would walk in, or when she knocked on one of the apartment doors, there she'd be, smiling and holding out her arms. Meantime, the nights were terrible. On the fourth day, having brushed her 18 milk teeth until the toothbrush was pink with blood, she stared out of the window through warm rain sprinkle at morning people going to work, children to school. Then, for a long time, no one passed. Then an old woman with a man's jacket roofed above her head against the fine rain. Then a man tossing seed on bare places in the grass. Then a tall woman walked past the window. No coat and nothing on her head. She touched her eyes with the back of her arm, the inside of her wrist. She was crying. Later, the sixth day, when the caseworker came, she thought about the crying woman, who looked nothing at all like Jean, was not even the same color. But before that, on the fifth day, she found, or rather saw, something that had been right there for her all along. Demoralized by unanswered prayers, bleeding gums, and hunger, she gave up goodness. She climbed up on a chair and opened the bread box. Leaning against the box of Lorna Doones was an envelope, was a word she recognized instantly. Her own name, printed in lipstick. She opened it, even before she tore into the cookie box, and pulled out a single sheet of paper with more lipstick words. She could not understand any, except her own name again, at the top. Jean, at the bottom, loud red marks in between. Soaking in happiness, she folded the letter back in the envelope, put it in her shoe, and carried it for the rest of her life. hiding it, fighting for the right to keep it, rescuing it from wastebaskets. She was 6 years old, an ardent first-grade student before she could read the whole page. Over time, it became simply a sheet of paper, smeared firecracker red, not one decipherable word left. But it was the letter, safe in her shoe, that made leaving with the caseworker for the first of two foster homes possible. She thought about the crying woman briefly then, more later, until the sight of her became an occasional heartbreaking dream. The wind that had been stirring the grass was carrying snow now, scarce, sandy, and biting like glass. The hitcher stopped to pull a serape from her duffel, then ran to catch up and wrap it around the walker's shoulders. Sweetie flailed her hands until she understood that she was being warmed, not prevented. Not once, while the wool cloth was being wrapped around her shoulders, did she stop walking. She kept on moving, chuckling.